A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been living next to a foundation excavation in Jerusalem long enough now that he started asking the interesting version of the noise question. Not how to block it, but why the blocking keeps failing. Acoustic windows are doing their job on the airborne side, yet the rumble still comes through. His analogy is bone conduction. The way you hear your own voice through your skull, no matter what's in your ears. And the question is whether anyone has tried to build an acoustic barrier at the foundation level, between adjacent buildings, to stop vibration from entering a structure through the ground in the first place. Is that mechanically viable? And as cities pack high-rises closer together, is this a problem we're going to have to solve, rather than just endure?
The bone conduction analogy is doing more work than Daniel might realize, because the ear really does have two parallel paths to the cochlea. Air conduction through the eardrum and the ossicles, and bone conduction straight through the skull. When you block the first path with earplugs, the second path is still wide open. That's why your own voice sounds muffled but still audible with earplugs in. The building has the same two paths. Airborne noise comes through the windows and the walls. Structure-borne noise comes up through the ground, into the foundation, and then the frame of the building re-radiates it into every room. The floor becomes the speaker.
So the window never sees the vibration. It's sitting there doing its job while the floor and the walls play the jackhammer on their own.
And the frequencies are different. Airborne construction noise is broad spectrum, but the stuff that travels through the ground is heavily filtered. The soil and bedrock act as a low-pass filter. High frequencies attenuate fast, within a few meters, while low frequencies, roughly 10 to 50 hertz for construction work, propagate much further. That's the rumble Daniel feels more than hears. It's below the range where acoustic windows are even rated to perform.
That's a point worth pausing on. Acoustic windows are rated for speech frequencies and above. The standard sound transmission class ratings focus on the range where human voices and traffic noise live. But the vibration from a pile driver is more like a subwoofer than a siren. It's not just quieter through the window. It's in a completely different register.
Right. And the human ear is less sensitive at those frequencies, which is why it feels like pressure or rumble rather than distinct sound. But the body still registers it. People living near construction sites report fatigue, sleep disturbance, even nausea from long-term exposure to low-frequency vibration, even when the measured decibel level isn't particularly high. The ear isn't the only sensor in the body.
So the question is really about whether you can put a barrier in the ground that does for structure-borne vibration, what the window does for airborne noise, and the answer starts with how waves actually move through the ground.
When a pile driver hits or a hydraulic hammer breaks rock, the energy goes into the ground as two families of waves. Body waves, P waves and S waves, travel through the interior of the soil and rock. Surface waves, Rayleigh waves, travel along the surface and they carry most of the energy. For adjacent buildings, the Rayleigh waves are the main event. They roll along the surface like ripples on water, and when they hit a foundation, they couple into the structure. The foundation moves, the frame moves, and the interior surfaces re-radiate that motion as low-frequency sound.
And the deeper the foundation, the more surface it presents to the wave. A high-rise with piles going down 30 meters is basically an antenna for ground vibration.
A very good antenna. That's why Daniel's situation is so frustrating. The building is structurally coupled to the ground by necessity. It has to stand on something. And whatever it stands on is in direct contact with the medium that's carrying the vibration from next door.
So what's the existing technology for screening vibration in the ground?
The established approach is a wave barrier. Either an open trench or an infilled trench placed between the source and the receiver. The physics is impedance mismatch. A Rayleigh wave traveling through soil hits a discontinuity. Air in an open trench or a soft material like bentonite slurry or gas-filled panels in an infilled one, and most of the energy reflects back or scatters. It can't cross the gap efficiently because the acoustic impedance of air is wildly different from soil.
How effective are they when they work?
The literature on open trenches beside railway lines and pile driving sites shows insertion loss of 10 to 20 decibels for well-designed barriers. That's a 50 to 80% reduction in amplitude for Rayleigh waves. The catch is the depth. A trench has to be roughly one wavelength deep to be effective. For low-frequency construction vibration at 10 to 50 Hz, with soil wave speeds in the hundreds of meters per second, the wavelength can be 10 to 30 meters. So your trench needs to be that deep.
10 to 30 meters? Between two existing high-rises?
In dense urban ground next to a building whose foundation you're trying to protect. You'd be excavating a deep, wide trench right beside the very structure you don't want to destabilize. The trench that screens the vibration is also a trench that removes lateral support from the adjacent foundation. That's the core tension.
So the solution is a hole so deep it might cause the problem it's solving.
And that's before the water table shows up. In Jerusalem, the water table has been rising for years. An open trench in that context is a canal waiting to happen, and water transmits vibration far better than air. A flooded trench loses most of its screening effect because the impedance mismatch collapses. Water has an acoustic impedance closer to soil than air does by orders of magnitude.
So the trench works on paper, in dry soil, with enough depth. In a real city, next to a real building, with groundwater, it's a different proposition.
The infilled barrier is the response to that. You dig the trench and fill it with something soft. Bentonite slurry, expanded polystyrene, gas-filled panels, rubber chips. The fill holds the trench open so it doesn't collapse. And if you choose the material right, it maintains the impedance mismatch. But choosing right is hard. The fill has to be soft enough to reflect the waves, but stiff enough to hold the trench walls. And it has to stay that way for the life of the project. If the fill compacts or saturates or degrades, the barrier stops working.
And all of this for a construction project that might last 18 months.
That's the other half of the problem. The trench is a major piece of civil engineering. You're excavating thousands of cubic meters of material, building a structure in the ground, and then either leaving it there forever or filling it back in when the project ends. For a temporary noise source, the economics are brutal.
I want to make sure I'm picturing this right. We're talking about a trench deeper than most building foundations, filled with engineered material, installed between two buildings in a dense urban environment, all to reduce the rumble from a construction project that has a fixed end date. And the alternative is just letting the neighbors endure it.
That's the calculation, and it's why most projects don't do it. The cost of the trench can exceed the cost of the piling itself, and the benefit is hard to quantify. You can measure decibel reduction, but how do you value a resident's sleep? How do you bill for the recording studio that doesn't lose clients? The economics favor the status quo unless there's a regulatory requirement or a lawsuit.
So the trench approach has real limits. But there's another approach, one that comes from an unexpected direction, earthquake engineering.
Base isolation. Instead of blocking the wave in the ground, you decouple the building from the ground. Bearings, typically layers of rubber and steel or sliding bearings, sit between the foundation and the superstructure. The ground can move, and the building above stays relatively still. It's well established for seismic protection. Buildings in Japan and California have been built on base isolators for decades, and they show dramatically reduced vibration from earthquakes.
And the same physics applies to construction vibration. If the foundation doesn't transmit motion to the structure doesn't radiate sound.
Exactly the same physics. A base-isolated building near a railway line feels far less vibration than a conventional one. There are new buildings going up near rail corridors with isolators installed specifically for that reason. The technology works.
But Daniel's building isn't new, and the construction is next door.
That's where the literature gets thin. Base isolation has been studied and applied for new buildings near vibration sources, but retrofitting an existing, occupied building to protect it from adjacent construction vibration, there's very little published research on that specific scenario. The question Daniel's asking is largely unaddressed.
Why is retrofitting so hard?
To put isolators under an existing building, you have to underpin it. You lift the building, cut the existing foundations, insert the bearings, and reconnect all the services. Water, sewer, Electrical conduits, gas lines, everything that crosses the foundation plane has to be made flexible. It's one of the most invasive things you can do to a structure. The cost is enormous, the technical risk is high, and the occupants are disrupted for months.
For a construction project next door, that might run 2 years.
The cost-benefit is rarely favorable. You'd be spending millions to retrofit a building for a temporary noise source, and when the construction ends, you've got a base-isolated building that now needs ongoing maintenance on its isolation system. The bearings have a service life. They need inspection. The building now moves slightly in ways it didn't before. Doors might not close the same way. Services need flexible couplings that can leak.
So the retrofit is a permanent solution to a temporary problem, with permanent costs.
And there's another wrinkle. Base isolation works best at the low frequencies that ground-borne vibration produces. That's the good news. But it changes the building's response to everything. Wind loads, seismic events, even the way the building settles over time. You're not just adding a component. You're changing the structural behavior of the whole system.
What about the active approach? Sensors encounter vibration.
Active vibration control. You put accelerometers on the building, measure the incoming vibration in real time, and drive actuators that push back in opposite phase. It's used in precision applications. Telescope mounts, semiconductor fabrication floors, some laboratory buildings. The technology is mature at small scale.
Whole building scale?
Expensive and energy intensive. You'd need actuators powerful enough to move significant structural mass, and the control system has to react faster than the vibration. For impulsive sources like pile driving, that's hard. Each strike is a sharp transient. By the time you've measured it and computed the counterforce, the next strike is on its way. Active control handles steady-state vibration well, a constant hum from machinery. But impulsive, unpredictable sources are the worst case.
So the three approaches are: dig a very deep trench, lift the building and put it on springs, or install a building-sized noise-canceling system. None of them sound like something a developer is going to volunteer to pay for.
And that points to where the real answer lies. The engineering solutions exist, but they're most viable when planned in advance. A new building can be designed with isolation from the start. A construction project can be sequenced to minimize vibration. Different piling methods, vibration monitoring, contractual limits on what's allowed at the property line. The magic material in the foundation is less practical than the boring stuff: pre-construction surveys, monitoring, and enforcement.
The answer to Daniel's question, has anyone considered a foundation-level acoustic barrier? Is yes in the form of trenches and wave barriers. Is it mechanically viable? Partially in the right conditions, with enough depth. But for an existing occupied building next to an active excavation, the practical answer is that it's rarely done because the cost and risk are enormous.
The bone conduction analogy has a limit. In hearing, bone conduction is a low-frequency path that bypasses the eardrum. The analogy holds for buildings. But on the solution side, you can't put earplugs in a building's foundations. The building is coupled to the ground by necessity. It has to stand on something.
Right. The ear can tolerate a little conductive hearing loss because the cochlea still gets what it needs. A building can't tolerate being decoupled from the ground. That's its whole job.
The ground is shared. That's the deeper point. When you excavate next to an existing building, you're not just making noise, you're shaking the medium that both buildings stand on. And the question of whether to block that path is really a question about who bears the cost of acknowledging that the ground is a shared resource.
As cities densify, the problem grows. More high-rises in direct proximity means more excavation next to occupied buildings. The physics doesn't change. Low-frequency vibration travels through the ground, and the ground doesn't care about property lines.
The solutions that work are the ones that get designed in, not bolted on. A new building near a future construction site can have isolation built in. A construction project can be planned to minimize vibration at the source. But the retrofit scenario, protecting an existing building from a neighbor's excavation, is the hardest case, and it's the one Daniel is living.
The technical answer is partially viable, rarely practical. The real insight is about planning and regulation, not materials.
The trench worked until it rained.
Say that again?
Late 90s, I was site engineer on a basement excavation in central London, right next to a Victorian building with a recording studio in it. The studio complained constantly about vibration. Every time the piling rig fired up, their tape machines picked it up. The contractor's solution was to dig a trench between the sites. Just an open trench, straight down, maybe 4 meters. It worked, mostly. The studio stopped complaining for about 3 weeks.
And then it rained.
The water table was higher than anyone planned for. The trench filled up, and the vibration came straight back. Water transmits vibration better than air. Everyone on site knew that, but nobody had checked the groundwater before they dug. So, we had a trench full of water, a studio full of angry engineers, and a client asking why the expensive hole wasn't doing its job.
The physics was right, and the hydrology was wrong.
The literature on open trenches assumes dry conditions. Urban water tables are rarely cooperative. And an infilled barrier needs the right material with the right impedance, which is harder than it sounds. You can't just fill a trench with whatever's cheap and expect it to screen vibration. The wrong fill is worse than no trench at all, because you've spent the money and destabilized the ground for nothing.
What did they end up doing?
They pumped the trench, lined it, and filled it with a bentonite slurry. It helped some. Not as much as the open trench had. The studio moved out before the project finished. They'd had enough.
The gap between the paper and the practice is about a week of rain.
A client who doesn't want to pay for groundwater monitoring. That's the part the research doesn't capture. The physics says a gas-filled trench is ideal. The real world fills it with water. My cousin does this now, vibration monitoring for construction in Birmingham. He says half his job is telling contractors their trench won't work before they dig it. They never listen. He's not to be trusted, but he's right about that.
The flooded trench is a perfect illustration of why the gap between theory and practice is so wide here. The impedance mismatch that makes the barrier work is exactly the thing that fails when water gets in. Air has an acoustic impedance about 3,000 times lower than water, so a dry trench is a mirror for Rayleigh waves. A flooded trench is a puddle.
It points to where the real answer might lie. Not in a magic material, but in the unglamorous work of knowing what's underground before you dig. Groundwater, soil stiffness, wave speeds. The barrier is only as good as the site investigation.
Most contractors won't pay for the site investigation. They'll pay for the trench, because they can see the trench. The investigation is just a report on a shelf.
That's the planning gap. The engineering solutions exist, but they're deployed without the measurements that would tell you whether they'll work. A trench is a visible fix. A groundwater survey is invisible. So the visible fix wins, and then it rains.
There's a broader pattern here that shows up in a lot of engineering failures. The visible, tangible intervention gets funded because it feels like progress. The invisible investigation gets cut because it feels like overhead. But the investigation is what tells you whether the visible intervention will actually work.
In this case, the investigation would have revealed the water table before the trench was dug. A few thousand pounds of boreholes and groundwater monitoring would have saved the cost of the trench, the cost of the remediation, and the cost of losing a tenant.
The studio was paying premium rent. They'd been there for years. The building owner wasn't happy. And it all traced back to a decision made in a site meeting where someone said, "It'll be fine. It never rains that much in London."
The open question is whether urban planning will catch up with the physics. As cities densify, will we see preemptive vibration isolation in new buildings, designing for the construction that will happen next door, decades later?
That's the forward-looking version of the question. Right now, we build as if the ground under the neighboring lot is someone else's problem, but the ground doesn't respect the property line. The vibration from a pile driver travels through the same soil under both buildings. The only way to manage that's to treat the ground as shared infrastructure, like the airspace above a street.
The bone conduction analogy suggests a deeper truth. We can't fully isolate a building from the ground it stands on, any more than we can fully isolate our ears from our skulls. The question isn't whether to block the path, but how to design cities that acknowledge the ground is shared.
That means vibration monitoring as a standard part of construction permits, pre-construction surveys of adjacent buildings, contractual limits on vibration at the property line, the boring stuff. But it's the boring stuff that would have kept that London studio in business.
The cutting room floor detail I liked, the wavelength math. At 10 hertz in stiff soil, a Rayleigh wave can be 30 meters long. That's the distance from crest to crest. Your trench has to be that deep to reflect it. 30 meters is a 10-story building. You're not digging a trench, you're digging a building-sized hole in the ground next to the building you're trying to protect.
That's before you account for the fact that the wavelength changes with the soil. The same 10 hertz wave in soft clay might be 15 meters. In bedrock, 40. So the trench depth isn't even a fixed number. It depends on what's under the site, which is another reason the site investigation has to come first.
I think that's the detail that makes the whole problem vivid. A trench isn't just a hole. It's a hole that has to be precisely sized to the wavelength of the vibration you're trying to block in the specific soil you're digging through. And if you get any of that wrong, you've spent a fortune on a hole that doesn't work.
The wavelength is tied to the frequency of the source. A pile driver produces a different frequency spectrum than a hydraulic hammer. So even if you design the trench for one piece of equipment, the contractor might switch to a different method halfway through the project, and suddenly your barrier is tuned to the wrong wavelength.
The trench has to be designed for the specific source, the specific soil, the specific water table, and the specific building you're protecting. It's not a generic solution. It's a bespoke piece of civil engineering for a temporary problem.
Which is why the planning approach is more robust. If you monitor vibration at the property line and set enforceable limits, the contractor has an incentive to choose quieter methods or to sequence the work in a way that minimizes the impact. The regulation doesn't require a specific technology. It just sets the boundary condition and lets the engineers figure out how to meet it.
That's the answer to Daniel's question in the end. The foundation-level acoustic barrier is mechanically viable in principle. But the practical version of the problem is better solved by treating the ground as shared infrastructure and regulating the vibration at the source.
We'll be watching to see if cities start doing that, or if we just keep digging trenches and hoping it doesn't rain.
We'll leave Daniel with this. The physics of a foundation-level acoustic barrier is real. The technology exists in the form of wave barriers and base isolation. But the practical version of the question, protecting an existing occupied building from a neighbor's excavation, is the hardest case, and the real solutions are more about planning than materials.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running. This has been My Weird Prompts, the Human-AI Collaboration Podcast. If you've got a question about physics, engineering, or anything else, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.